Robert Edward Keenan killed himself in the fall of 1999. I wasn't there, but it's where my story begins. It begins with Rob, 17 years old, sitting in a burning car in the middle of a crowded parking lot one Monday night in October. He burned for nearly 4 hours before the police let the firemen near enough to put out the flames and put out his body. I didn't know him. Not really. We lived in a small town. I knew him by sight and knew his name. I doubt we'd ever exchange more than a few perfunctory words. It makes me feel funny talking about him. Like I'm not justified doing it, but I'm going to tell you about the spire. It's unavoidable. I have to tell you about Robert Edward Keenan and how the suicide note he left behind tangled up my life with his. Back then, we both lived in a sleepy town in New England, a little over an hour northwest of Boston, just across the New Hampshire border. The sort of place that's nice to live, if you're the sort of person that doesn't like doing very much. There's really only three reasons anyone stepped foot in my hometown. The first is that they're on their way over to Nashua, the shopping mecca of the Northeast. The second would be the ice cream. You have a dairy farm where they sell the world's best ice cream, all of it made right there on the premises. And the third is because they bought one of those haunted New England books. Usually you can find our town listed in those books twice. The first entry will likely be the story of how our high school is one of the 10 oldest in the country, came to have the Silver Spectre as its mascot, and I always loved the Spectre. It reflected how steeped in folklore rural New England once was, and as mascots go, it's much more interesting than the fighting fill-in-the-cat species here, and everyone else seems to have saddled with. Way back in the 1890s, there was a terrible blizzard. A proper nor'easter. It dumped several feet of snow across the whole region. There were many, many casualties, mostly the very young and very old, stuck in their homes without heat. One of the exceptions was neither very young nor very old. It was Jennifer Wilkins. She was a teacher trapped in the school when the blizzard hit. What little food there was in the schoolhouse couldn't have lasted more than 2 days. And folks say by the fifth, she had resorted to boiling her boots to soften up the leather for eating. It was 2 weeks before anyone was able to reach her. They found her body, thin as a matchstick, wrapped up in a gray wool blanket. If only they'd had paste in those days, she might have made it. That old schoolhouse is now our town rec center. Supposedly, old Jenny still haunts its halls, wrapped in that gray wool blanket. Her hollow, emaciated visage searching in vain for something to eat. Once when I was 8 or 9 years old, long before I knew the origins of the Silver Spectre, I went up into the rec center's attic alone. It was August. I had snuck away from the rest of the summer reading program in my own interminable boredom. The dusty attic was filled with broken furniture and plastic bins containing the crafting supplies for all the daycare programs. Would have been entirely forgettable if not for the drafts. The summer had been hot and humid, but in the rec center's attic, if you stepped in the wrong spot, it'd get so cold that you could practically see your breath. I told my mom about it. She was the one who told me about Jenny. Never went back there alone. The second story you typically find in those books is about the Blood Cemetery. Its real name is the Pine Hill Cemetery, but nobody calls it that. They call it the Blood Cemetery, because it's supposedly haunted by Abel Blood and his family. According to legend, Abel Blood lived in the center of what is now the cemetery back when it was farmland. He returned from the fields early one day to find his wife in bed with another man, a tall, dark-haired stranger. Abel was stunned. How could Mrs. Blood, a good Christian woman, do such a thing? Obviously, the scoundrel was forcing himself on his wife. Abel retrieved his pitchfork and charged back into the house, his mind full of vengeance. But as he drew near, he heard his wife, mid-coitus, proclaim her love for the black-haired stranger. And with a note of satisfaction to her call that Abel had never heard before. Mr. Blood saw red. He burst into the room, pitchfork aloft, and ran them through. Over and over, he plunged the fork into their tangled bodies before finally leaving them pinned, one on top of the other, to the bed beneath them. Looking back at the bloody mess he'd made, Abel found his rage had not diminished. This seemed curious to Abel, but it dawned on him why when he spied a picture of his family on the mantle. whose children didn't look anything like him, nor like their mother. They were all exceptionally tall, with full heads of somewhat greasy black hair. Abel waited, standing in the puddle of blood that had only moments ago been coursing through Mrs. Blood and her lover, and stewed in his ever-deepening anger. He was a cuckold. He had no heir. He had been raising another man's child, a man who had been bedding Abel's wife for years. Abel waited and stewed for several hours until his four children arrived home from school. They say his sons and eldest daughter put up a noble fight. But they were children fighting a grown man whose muscles had been hardened by a lifetime of farm labor. Only Abel's youngest daughter, barely 5 years old, made it out of the house alive. She sprinted as fast as her little legs could carry her in a desperate attempt to reach her neighbors. But even with her head start, her little legs were no match for the father's powerful strides. Just as she scrambled over the stone wall separating their farm from the Hollises, Abel picked up one of the stones and smashed it down on her head. These days, if you go there, on the road that borders the cemetery, you'll see this curve, full of skid marks. People say that they're caused by cars swerving to avoid an oddly dressed little girl who runs out into the street each night. Back home, he had a rite of passage. As soon as you or one of your friends were old enough to drive, you had to trespass into the Blood Cemetery at night and make a rubbing of the family's gravestones. I did it. And you should feel free to, but be prepared to be disappointed because none of the Bloods died on the same date. See, a lot of the ghost stories are like that, right? It doesn't mean they're not fun, but what you come to realize as you get older is that they're mostly a form of social control. Jennifer Wilkins really did die a horrible death, but the story of Abel Blood is nothing but a fantasy story with a rather dark, misogynistic message. Cheat on your husband and he'll kill you. I loved ghost stories growing up. I loved them. It gave me my not entirely unearned reputation as the spooky kid. It was the reason that about a month after he died, Rob Keenan's suicide note wound up in my lap. There, buried in the middle of apologies to his family and clear evidence of severe depression, was my first push towards the spire in the woods. The only ghost story I truly believe. In 1999, I was a sophomore in high school. Rob was a senior. He wasn't what you call real popular. Part of it was that he wasn't born in my hometown, but moved there in the seventh grade, right when kids are at their cruelest. The first time I ever heard of him was a year later. There was a rumor floating around that he and a mentally handicapped girl were found naked in the woods together, the implication being that he tricked her into having sex with him. Now, a couple years later, I heard another, that his parents were forced to move because Rob had been molested by their old priest down in Amherst. Now, to the best of my knowledge, these stories are entirely untrue, and I'm deeply ashamed to admit that when I was in the sixth grade, I did gleefully repeat the first one. See, I found it funny at the time, right? The second one I also repeated, just not as gleefully. I whispered it to my friends, adopting a sage tone, offering it as an explanation for why the first rumor was probably true. I felt so goddamn smart. I had the inside scoop, something interesting to say, and everyone wanted to listen to me. Wish I'd kept my mouth shut. I wasn't smart. I was just kicking a kid while he was down, spreading lies that may have contributed to him killing himself. The rumors followed Rob everywhere. He was a quiet kid. By all accounts, very bright and kind, and I want to be clear here, he did have people who cared about him. Friends. Not many, and maybe they weren't too popular either, but they were there, and they were nice guys. One of them was my ride to school, Nathan Fletcher. Fletcher and I lived in the same neighborhood. We were never all that close, but we got along well enough. He was a lovable goofball, always saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, but it never got him down. He had this grin that stretched from ear to ear, and he always managed to get me excited about his latest musical discovery or restoration project. Fletch used to buy old cars, fix them up, resell them. While it helped pad his savings for college, it also meant that he was stuck driving whatever hunk of junk he hadn't managed to fix up enough to sell yet. That year, Fletcher was driving a 1984 Honda Civic. I still hate that car. Found out something was wrong on Tuesday morning when Fletcher's rust bucket didn't show up in my driveway, like it usually did. Instead, his dad, an Air Force officer, nowhere near as affable as his son, was waiting for me. I liked Mr. Fletcher fine. He was a good, if not particularly affectionate, father to his boys and respectful neighbor. But his presence in my driveway was odd, especially since I could see that Fletch wasn't in the car. Sir, is everything okay with Nate?
Yeah, he's fine. We're just giving him day off school. Come on, grab your bag. I'll explain on the way.
Mr. Fletch had turned around and started back toward his car before he even finished speaking. I grabbed my backpack and I hustled after him.
You know the Keenan boy?
He asked as we pulled out of my driveway. Not really. I mean, I know who he is. One of Nate's friends. Mr. Fletcher nodded, never taking his eyes off the road.
He killed himself last night.
He said it as evenly as if he'd been announcing we needed to stop for gas. He what? My brain couldn't even process what I was hearing. I'd seen Rob Keaton in the hallway yesterday. How could he be dead? Mr. Fletcher proceeded to lay out the cold, dry facts. Rob had hand-delivered a letter to the house around 7 p.m. Fletch wasn't home when Rob dropped it off, so he didn't open it until later that night, at 9:45 or so. Upon reading the letter, Fletch went white as a ghost and tore out of the house without permission. He raced to, I'm going to omit this detail just so you don't know its location, that Rob had killed himself, but when he arrived, the car was already burning. Apparently the letter was a suicide note.
Nathan's too upset for school.
Something in how he said it made it seem like Mr. Fletcher was implying there was something unmanly about his 17-year-old son being too upset to sit through pre-calculus after one of his best friends had killed himself.
He should have called you,
Mr. Fletcher continued,
but he didn't think to, and it didn't occur to me until it was too late for you to catch the bus. Sorry about that.
My initial shock gave way to resentment. No one could have made Rob Keenan's suicide pleasant news, but it was difficult to imagine anyone being more callous than Mr. Fletcher. No wonder Fletch complained about his father so much. Yet, no, don't worry about it, he mumbled. We rode the rest of the way in silence. I got to school and found it changed compared to the day before. It was an alien landscape. It reminded me of Tartarus in Greek mythology, a bunch of people milling about, a vacant and lost look in their eyes, unsure of what to do, what to say to one another. Friends clustered silently in small groups. It was like Rob's funeral was being held in the hallways. Classes weren't canceled, but nothing was done. Mainly the teachers made us aware of special counseling being offered for anyone closely affected and told us that we could come into them if we ever needed to. Their nerves were also frayed. I recall specifically my study hall teacher, normally a very soft-spoken man, banging his head on his desk and swearing that it was completely fucking unnecessary, adding a moment later that no one needs to do that, no one. We all of us drifted through the day in a haze. You'd hug your friends, you'd ask them how they were holding up, or how well they knew Rob. You'd hear about who was there that night at the omitted location that was a popular teen hangout, and you heard about the cops that could have saved him, but didn't. I mentioned earlier that Rob Keenan was left in his burning car for 4 hours. That's not an exaggeration. It was 4 hours. Later reports say less time had passed, but Fletch was there, screaming himself hoarse, screaming at the cops and firemen or anyone who would listen that was his friend in there, and he was dying. It was 4 hours. Being teenagers, we were quick to question the actions of the police, but I now believe that while their delay proved to be without merit, they made the best decision they could have with the information available to them. Rob hadn't lit himself on fire to be dramatic. He didn't intend for there to be a fire at all. Rob had wanted to shoot himself. Back then, in the 90s, in the pre-9/11 world, terrorism wasn't part of the zeitgeist. I mean, it was bad, absolutely terrible, and we knew it. We'd had Timothy McVeil and his failed bombing of the Twin Towers, but We hadn't entered into that neo-McCarthyism that marked much of the early 2000s, where the mere whisper of the word could get you thrown off of an airplane or placed in an FBI watch list. And there was a certain cliché, a mystique, that came with the equipment and ideas surrounding terrorism carried in the imaginations of adolescent boys. Which is probably why Rob Keenan, like virtually every other guy I knew growing up, had copies of the Anarchist Cookbook and the Terrorist Handbook, save for the 3.5-inch floppy that he had stashed in his room. When he failed to get a gun, he built one. I'm a little wary to Google it, but if my memory serves, the instruction for it are listed in one of those text files as the homebrew blast cannon. Rob's blast cannon consisted of a little more than a lead pipe capped on one end and filled with gunpowder and bits of metal. I mean, it did the trick. But it also launched burning gunpowder all over the interior of his car. Some of the people at the scene thought they had seen someone else in the car with Rob, a girl, and relayed this information to Officer McCullough. He was the first emergency responder to arrive. Officer McCullough hadn't seen anyone else in the car. All he saw was a burning car, a crowd of teenagers who all reported having heard an explosion, and the lead pipe that had rolled out of Rob's unconscious hand and onto the passenger side of the floor. Terrorism may not have been a big part of the zeitgeist at the time, but school shootings were. Columbine Massacre had happened only 6 months prior, and Officer McCullough was looking at a fairly typical teen loner. Reports of an explosion and what very well could have been in an undetonated pipe bomb still in the burning car. He made a tough call. It may have cost Rob Keenan his life, but then again, he might have already been dead. And you have to ask yourself about what that officer did. Was it worth risking more lives to find out? I remember thinking that Officer McCullough at that point was only known to me as the cop who always gave kids a hard time for riding their bikes without a helmet. You know, and maybe he was a bastard. But if he was, it wasn't because of this. He couldn't risk more lives. Besides, whether or not it was suicide, if there had been a second person in the car, where the hell was she? Nobody who knew Robert Edward Keenan at all, and even people like me who barely knew him, believed for a second that he was out to kill a whole bunch of people. But there was something else he could have been going on. Rob had a crush on a girl that bordered on obsession. It lasted years and only seemed to be getting worse. The girl in question, Alina, Rob would go out of his way to stand in her line or linger at the parking lot after hours, hoping to speak with her as she was heading home. Everyone immediately wondered if that mystery girl in the fire had been Alina. Did he pull her into his car to once more profess his love for her and, unable to handle another rejection, take his own life before her eyes? Or, God forbid, try to take Alina's with him? Alina's friends and co-workers shouted her name. Alina! Alina, where are you? When she didn't respond, they fanned out to look for her. It was the manager, Mrs. Jaffrey, who found her. Completely overwhelmed by Rob's suicide, Alina had retreated into one of the walk-in freezers. She was bawling her eyes out as Mrs. Jaffrey threw her coat over Alina's shoulders and led her to the manager's office. "It's not your fault," the older woman whispered into Alina's ear. But it didn't do any good. No one else was accountable for her. And no mystery woman was ever found. No second bomb ever exploded. No accomplices ever turned up. I guess we all assumed that those eyewitnesses were mistaken, that the smoke and the flames had played a trick on their eyes. We were wrong. Fletch wasn't in school for the rest of the week, and I didn't see him around the neighborhood either. I hate to admit it, but it sort of was a relief. I had no idea what I was going to say to him. What do you really say to someone whose friend had just killed himself? In the weeks that followed, a new form of gossip slowly crept into the hallways of the school. The special counseling held in the cafeteria every morning before homeroom was supposed to be a safe place, where anyone could share their feelings about fear or of judgment and be secure in the knowledge that it would go no further. So naturally, it was all anyone wanted to talk about. There was a strong backlash against the kids the other students didn't feel deserved to be there, people who presented themselves as having been very close to Rob, but who in truth rarely spoke with him. Several of my close friends had been there that night. They had watched Rob burn, seen him die, And although they were deeply affected, they weren't even entirely comfortable being there amongst his handful of close friends, and of course, Alina. I felt terrible for Alina Aminev, sitting there in the cafeteria surrounded by Rob's grieving friends, listening to everyone tiptoe around blaming her. They never came out and said it, but they talked about how girls wouldn't give him the time of day, how someone had recently ripped out his heart, and when the counselor spoke about how challenging it can be to cope with the insensitivity of other teens, many of the room cast sidelong glances in her direction, waiting for her reaction before adding in their own two cents. The year before Rob's death, Alina had suddenly found herself with a kind of unexpected popularity. She was born in Russia, but her parents had managed to immigrate to the United States when Alina was still an infant, which was during the tail end of the Cold War. Not an easy feat. Kids used to tease her about her family being Soviet spies. When she started coming into her own, teasing turned into flirting. She never quite reached the ranks of our school's alpha females, but her je ne sais quoi was undeniable. Alina was pretty, sure, but not unattainably so. She was smart, but not so much so that it was intimidating. She had fair skin and wild hair. Her eyes would sparkle whenever she said something clever, and she had this smirk that spread like a wave from left to right across her lips. Most alluring of all, Alina had this attitude, this way of carrying herself. It was like she was sure wherever she was the place to be. It was infectious. In short, Alina Aminev was exactly the kind of girl that an unpopular guy could fool himself into thinking he had a chance with. God knows, I did when I found myself suddenly talking to her in late November of 1999. Alina had grown quieter in the weeks that followed Rob's death. Even as the rest of the school began to show signs of moving on, she continued to retreat. She quit her job, and though I don't quite remember when the season started and stopped, either quit or never signed up for cross country that year. She just sort of shut herself off from the world and everyone in it, which was why I was so surprised to see her at Drew DeLuca's birthday party. She was nervous. This used to be her element, and no one at Drew's that night was indicated to blame her for Rob's death. This was not his circle of friends, this was hers. But whenever she approached someone or tried to join in on a conversation, she looked like a gazelle approaching a watering hole. I wasn't sure if it was safe. And when she was in the conversation, she mainly shifted her weight from foot to foot or fidgeted with some part of her outfit, never really engaging anyone unless they addressed her directly. I was telling a friend of mine about a recent trip I had taken to Greenfield with Scary Carrie, the only one that I could drag along on a ghost hunting trip, when I felt a gentle tug on the back of my shirt. I turned around having to see DeLuca's kid sister, but it was Alina.
Can we talk?
Yeah, sure.
Outside?
She looked over my shoulder at my friends before adding,
alone?
If it had been spring, I would have been thrilled by the prospect of Alina Aminev pulling me out of the party to talk alone. But it wasn't spring. It was New Hampshire, in late November. We stood on the back deck, our jackets pulled tightly around us, our breath hanging in the air, plain to see. She said she heard from Christy McDowell, but I knew a lot about ghost stories. Christy was quite possibly my oldest friend in the world, and yes, it was true. I knew a lot about ghost stories. I was raised Catholic and blessed with kind, warm-hearted parents who I was always eager to please. This meant I took my Catholicism and my schoolwork very seriously, which eventually led to a struggle between my rational and spiritual beliefs that was only exacerbated by my growing awareness that the sexual abuse scandal and the church's subsequent cover-up. I had hated losing my faith. I wanted desperately to believe as I had a child. So when most teenagers had shut the book on ghost stories, relegating them to little more than childhood memories or an excuse to scare a girl you wanted to put your arm around, I doubled down. I thought if I could find something, some shred of evidence in support of the supernatural, that would keep the door to the spiritual world open for me, even if only for a time. Of course, I didn't share all that with Alina. Instead, I tried to act casual. Casual, bordering on slightly disinterested. Yeah, well, kinda. I think she could see through me. Why? Alina began fishing around inside her jacket.
You have to swear to me that you'll never tell anyone I showed you this.
I swore. Alina pulled her hand from her coat, her dainty fingers clutching an envelope like it was a particularly delicate piece of glass. She handed me Rob's suicide note. Opening the envelope and unfolding the pages felt like a profound invasion of privacy, but who could resist reading it when it was handed to you? What were Rob Keenan's last words to the girl he'd been obsessed with for years, the girl many of his peers believed was the reason he killed himself? 13 years have passed, leaving me with little more than an impression of what the note said. But even if I remembered it exactly, I think this would be where I draw the line. What I'd say is, it was very earnest. Rob had been depressed for a long time. He felt horrible about leaving his family and his friends to deal with the aftermath of his suicide, but he also felt isolated, and in a very profound way, and more than anything, he just wanted it to stop. I also don't mind sharing that he was very effusive in his praises for Alina, but I got the distinct impression that he didn't know her as well as he thought. He wrote about her in 3 florid terms full of superlatives. Once he said that he didn't think he could live without her, but ultimately nothing he said was very specific. Everyone thinks that the first love of their life is the most special, the most attractive person in the world, and that no one could appreciate them as deeply as they do. I felt for him. I really did. But reading it, I didn't feel as though I'd gotten to know him any better. Not really. As I finished reading, I looked up and I met Alina's gaze. She was looking at me expectantly, but I wasn't making the connection. Okay, what does this have to do with ghost stories? I asked. Alina pointed to the bottom of one of the paragraphs, expounding on why Rob wanted to take his own life. It read, "And every hour I see her face, as she runs the endless race." Her face. I had assumed that he was talking about Alina and her years of running track and cross country, but if that was the case, why would he write her and not your in a letter that was to Alina? A shiver ran up my spine. It wasn't cold. It was more like someone had walked over my grave. "The endless race," I said.
"Yes."
For a split second, Alina was her former self again.
"God, I was starting to think I'd imagined it. Tell me, you remember where it's from?"
I mumbled the line, "And every hour I see her face as she runs the endless race." A couple of times under my breath, I knew that I'd heard it before, but where? I was positive it was a ghost story, but I hadn't... Oh, I'd read literally hundreds, if not thousands of them, and they had a tendency to bleed together. No.
Shit!
Alina banged her fist against the railing of the deck.
"But it was a ghost story, right?"
Yeah, I know it. I just can't... I trailed off, racking my brain. Alina started drifting back towards Drew's house.
"Well, if you think of it..." I cut her off. "Absolutely!"
So much for slightly disinterested. As she reached the door, she turned around and looked at me. She stared at me for a long time, longer than any pause in a conversation should be.
"I think he mentioned it in the one he wrote to Nate Fletcher, too."
I stared back at Alina.
"Fletcher's letter?"
"Yeah.
Did you find it?"
That's a line I didn't think I could cross. "Yeah." A few days after Rob's suicide, a handful of young reporters showed up at the school, trawling for quotes. Before the faculty could chase them out, they pushed hard for someone, anyone, to give support to the lone wolf school shooter angle. Rob's real friends flatly refused to speak to the reporters, but there's a certain element among young people who only want attention, and the same kids who showed up for the grief counseling, despite never having been particularly close to Rob, were the first in line to provide quotes. The next day, the local paper was filled with statements like, "No one really knew him," says student Melissa Bennett. For Fletch, it was a slap in the face. What? Because she didn't know him, nobody could? But a week or so after Rob died, Fletch resumed picking me up in the morning. I don't count! Murph doesn't count! Fucking bullshit! Listening to him rant about the story in the paper made me think that maybe I should have spoken to the reporters. I wouldn't have pretended to have some kind of special insight into Rob's mental state, but it might have been nice for his friends and family to have seen something simple and honest. Something that didn't fit the lone wolf narrative. Even if it was nothing more than saying, he had friends. They're just not talking to you because they're grieving, you heartless parasite. I wish I'd done that. But I didn't. I also wish I could tell you that I wrote something the following week roasting the reporters for coming into a school and pushing students still reeling from the shock of losing a classmate into spouting a bunch of pop, psycho, pseudo-scientific nonsense, but that wasn't me either. That was some senior I didn't know very well. Now, I made a few tenuous attempts at getting Fletch to open up about Rob. The best I had managed was to get him ranting about the kids in the grieving council session that didn't belong. Talking about them got the normally placid Fletch so angry, I thought he might have an aneurysm. After that, I quickly gave up. Once I resolved to not pry into Fletch's life, our morning rides settled into something almost comfortable. Our casual friendship was like a knee recovering from an injury, fine so long as we didn't put any weight on it. And that was still the state of things the day that we returned to school after Drew DeLuca's birthday. Today, tracking down the story that led me to the spire would have been a piece of cake. For me, anyway. For you, I've changed too many details. I could have typed this little rhyming snippet of Rob's suicide note into Google and had my answer in seconds, but the internet wasn't as robust back then. Hell, I'm pretty sure in 1999 I was still using Hotbot. Nonetheless, from the second I returned from Drew's until school started on Monday, I spent every waking minute scouring every haunted places book and paranormal website I could find, looking for the phrase, "In every hour I see her face as she runs the endless race," or some variation. By the end of the weekend, half the contents of the bookshelf had been redistributed throughout the house, and I had skimmed countless GeoCities pages, scrolling past dancing ghost gifs and dancing ghost gif until my eyes bled, but still, I had nothing to show for it. I knew I couldn't bring it up with Fletch. Not directly, at any rate. Rob's death was still a raw nerve, so I went to the only person who knew even more about ghost stories than I did. Scary Carrie. Growing up in the woods of New Hampshire at the foot of White Mountains wasn't all that bad. My school had a hiking club that also taught us elementary wilderness and survival skills. It was immensely popular, mainly because it culminated into a week-long hike, which meant you got to miss a week of school. As freshmen, my friends and I all signed up to go together that fall, but 2 weeks before the big event, I came down with a case of antibiotic-resistant strep throat, and I had to have my tonsils removed. Fun. Since the program was extremely popular, each student could only partake once. Even though I was allowed to make up my hike the following winter, it was still a bit of a letdown since none of my friends could come with me. I was intensely jealous when my friends returned from the hike closer than ever with a slew of inside jokes and stories from their week in the woods, but by the time I left for my hike a few months later, things in my circle of friends had already returned to normal. I was mainly just concerned about being stuck in the woods with random classmates I had little in common with. If you spent all day hiking with a large frame pack, you may not appreciate how grueling it can be. It's a high washout rate of kids who get sick or throw in the towel and have to be picked up and taken home. There's an even higher rate of kids who never shut up about how much their feet hurt, and by the time that we stopped for lunch on the first day, any concerns I had of loneliness were replaced by my seething hatred for that group of kids. Those of us capable of keeping our mouths shut, at least about our feet, quickly bonded. That's how I became friends with Scary Carrie Peterson, the last person on Earth I'd ever imagine I'd become close to. Carrie was one of those unlucky people that seemed scientifically designed to be picked on. She was nearly 6 feet tall, quite overweight, crap at school, poor by the standards of my admittedly affluent town, and cursed, with a head the size of a large pumpkin. I'd had classes with Carrie on and off for the last 9 years, and before the hike, I doubt I'd spoken more than 2 words to her. Although, in fairness to me, in middle school, she had deepened her own isolation from most of the class by becoming intensely goth on the baby bat way of the late 90s teens. There was a blonde girl on the hike. I think her name was Stephanie Foster, that 2 hours later I had found very cute, and despite her whining, I was still thinking I might like to get to know her a little bit better before she let this gem slip.
God, I just wanted to miss school. Why do we have to walk so much?
I rolled my eyes. I didn't say anything. Carrie, however, could not let it slide.
What the hell do you think this hike was?
Stephanie looked at her like Carrie was something she'd scraped off the bottom of her boots.
Nobody's talking to you.
And nobody wants to fucking listen to you. I couldn't help it. I laughed. I still didn't think of Scary Carrie as a friend yet, but it was suddenly a lot harder not to like her. After lunch, our line of hikers silently and seemingly unconsciously rearranged our marching order, with the whiners taking up the rear, and those of us who could keep our aches and pains to ourselves leading the pack. By dinner time, Stephanie and 3 other girls from her clique, perhaps unimpressed by the franks and beans we were having, decided to throw in the towel. It gets dark early in the winter. Dark and cold. On the fall hike after dinner, my friends were able to wander around the campsite quite a bit, but for us, there was only one thing to do. Sit close to the fire. And that's where Carrie and I really bonded. Someone half-jokingly asked if anyone knew any good ghost stories. Well, there was the usual student reluctance to step up and put yourself out there to be judged, and our chaperones weren't terribly interested in anything but double-checking our work setting up the tents. But after a few false starts from other kids, I decided to tell an old standby. The story of an old woman that lived in Maine, who had been caught abducting pets and small children. It was said that she was a witch who ate the flesh of her victims and turned their bones into china. The second I finished, Carrie started telling one of hers. We took turns telling stories the rest of the night and continued telling stories every night after for the rest of the week. Between campsites, we walked next to each other, chatting about the kind of crap that seemed important to teenagers and quizzing each other on local paranormal hotspots. Now, back at school, after the hike, maintaining my friendship with Carrie proved to be tricky. My friends never really understood the bond. They weren't mean to her, not exactly, but despite my efforts to bring her into the fold, they never embraced her. As for the few friends Carrie had, some couldn't mask their disdain for my taste in music and clothing. Well, others were the sort of kids that were desperate and clingy. Two things I always found to be hard to stomach. But Carrie was one of the only people I could talk to about losing my faith. She was always game to get together and go on one of my very fruitless ghost hunts. So we stayed in regular contact. The Monday after my conversation with Alina, I tracked down Scary Carrie in the cafeteria, sitting with a few other goth kids. We'd talked a lot after Rob killed himself, in part because I knew that Carrie, from time to time, had suicidal thoughts of her own. Now, it must have been the height of stupidity, but until Rob Keenan actually ended his own life, I never thought that it could happen in my town. At least not to anyone I knew. After Rob had done it, though, I knew I couldn't let Carrie slip down that same path, and for a while, I doubled my efforts to spend time with her, but after one particularly awkward night ghost hunting in Greenfield, well, we had fallen back into status quo.
Carrie, you mind if I steal you for a second?
I asked, pointing back out into the hallway behind me. As Carrie rose to leave, Kim Murray leaned over to one of their other friends and said,
"Aww."
She'd just seen something cute. Carrie's face splotched with scarlet and shot Kim a look of pure hatred. Forget it, come on, I said. I didn't know what Carrie had told Kim about Greenfield, but she didn't even want to deal with it. Once we were in the hallway and out of everyone's earshot, I recounted the events of Drew DeLuca's party.
She let you read the note that he left her?
Even though, just a month ago, we'd spent several hours being lectured by our guidance counselor about the differences between depression, the true depression that was a psychological illness, and being sad, I think Carrie still had trouble believing anyone was more miserable than she was. Carrie stepped closer to me and dropped her voice to a whisper.
Why'd he do it? Was it her fault?
I trusted Carrie, but I was reluctant to share too much with her. I hate to admit it, but in spite of having counted Carrie amongst my friends for the past year, Alina's pretty face had flipped my loyalties completely to her on one conversation. I cut to the chase. Rob wrote something in Alina's note. I swear it was from a ghost story, but I can't remember which one.
What'd it say?
And every hour, I see her face as she runs the endless race. Scary Carrie shivered. The widower's clock. I hate that one. While my story begins with Rob Keenan killing himself, the story of the spire in the woods begins almost a century earlier in the former town of Enfield, Massachusetts, a few years before it was destroyed. In the late 1920s, an elderly clockmaker from Boston married a beautiful young girl, and the two of them settled in Enfield. He was a master craftsman, the finest in the world, able to create machines of such complexity and precision that he was often called the Da Vinci of clockworks. No small feat, considering Da Vinci himself had designed clockwork automations. She was a great beauty. Refined and cultivated before meeting the clockmaker, she had been celebrated by the Boston Brahmin for her wit and for throwing the very best dinner parties. The clockmaker had amassed a great fortune, but he, like all great artists, was unsatisfied by all the products of his lifetime of labor. He wanted to build one more clock, a clock that would surpass even Munich's Rathaus Glockenspiel in its artistry and complexity. He completed his plans in the spring of 1931. They were beautiful. His designs were classic, yet modern, complex, yet clean. Each hour when the bells called out the time, the automations would dance forth from their hidden chambers and symbolically reenact different battles of the Civil War, each day telling the story of how the North came to vanquish the South. Lowell and Boston both desperately wanted the clock tower, as did a few other larger manufacturing and shipping companies, but before construction could begin on any town hall, courthouse, or corporate headquarters, the Depression hit. All the suitors disappeared in short order, one after one, leaving the clockmaker alone with his plans. Miserable and depressed, the clockmaker feared he would die before he had the chance to see his vision complete. He resolved that he wouldn't let it happen and began spending his considerable fortune building the tower on his own as an addition to his house in Enfield. One day, the clock tower nearly complete, the clockmaker returned home from picking up a custom-made part. He arrived much earlier than anticipated to discover his wife in bed with another man, one of his laborers. The clockmaker burst into the room and screamed at his wife and her lover. He had never been so angry or humiliated in all of his life, but he didn't yet know what humiliation was. Rather than begging his forgiveness or cower before him or even flee the room in shame, the clockmaker's wife and her lover laughed at him. They told the clockmaker that he was an impotent old man. They were unafraid of him. "Run along back to your little gears and springs," his wife said. "Maybe if you're nice and quiet, I'll fix you your dinner tonight." The clockmaker, in a state of shock, slunk back to his gears and springs, but rather than going to work on the clock, he went to work on a plan. He removed the automations from their posts, and he set all of his meager strength to coiling the huge spring that ran beneath their tracks. He laid out his tools so they would be near at hand, and then he waited, listening to the rhythms of his marriage bed, slamming again and again against the wall. Eventually, the rhythmic thuds reached their crescendo and then fell quiet, and soon after he heard his wife calling out to him, but he said nothing. Her calls grew urgent, and repentance crept into her voice. Would she really be concerned for him, after what she said? Still, the clockmaker stayed silent. When the laborer entered the room, which was little more than a giant gearbox, the clockmaker stared at him, but did not move. The laborer leaned back out of the room and called to his lover, "He's in here! He hasn't done anything stupid, has he?" "No, he's fine," the clockmaker, was not fine. The laborer approached the clockmaker as cautiously as a man approaches an unfamiliar dog. "It's your fault, you know." The clockmaker, his watery eyes unblinking, only responding by staring at the younger man approaching him. "Fine lady like that, fancy. You can't keep her in a cage, especially around here in this dreadful place, and expect she won't get bored." It was at that exact moment that the laborer stepped across the path of the automaton's track, and the clockmaker yanked out the pin holding the spring coiled. The post, unburdened by a man-sized figure, brimmed with heavy metal gears, racing along the track and collided with the soft flesh of the laborer's leg. The crack of the bone splintering was even louder than the man's screams. The clockmaker's wife called out at the sound of her lover's cries, "I'm coming!" Clockmaker picked up a large wrench and moved beside the door. As his wife rushed in, her eyes searching for her lover, the clockmaker crept up behind her and brought the wrench down on her skull. She awoke several hours later, with shooting pains running through her legs. She tried to look down, but her head was an agony to move. The clockmaker stood over her, his mallet hammering the metal support rods into her thighs. Her lover was already mounted to the post, ready to fill in for the automaton and dance when the hour struck. Just as with the Rathis Glockenspielen unit, the clockmaker's creation was hailed as a great artistic achievement. The crowds gathered on the formerly quiet street to watch the myriad Union and Rebel automatons zip across their tracks, round and round in an endless race. It was weeks before anyone noticed something wrong with two of the automatons. Their lacquered veneer bulged in weird places and looked slick, as if it were wet. Then one day, the finish gave way and the crowd, which was mostly children at this point, watched in horror as two corpses zipped along the track, chasing and stabbing at each other with bayonets. They say that even after the clock was stopped and the lovers were laid to rest, all those who saw the wife's face were haunted by visions of her endlessly running across their track. I didn't have to ask why Scary Carrie hated the story of the widower's clock. She was the one who pointed out to me how ghost stories were frequently used as a form of social control. Here was another story where an unfaithful woman was put to death by an angry husband, and crueler still, children were also punished. Children whose only crime was having seen the corpse of the unfaithful woman, a corpse that enraged husband put on display. I couldn't wait to tell Alina. I didn't have any classes with her, but we had lunch the same period. Alina was sitting at the table with her friends. Ordinarily, it would have been intimidating to walk up to a table of girls, most of whom were pretty and toned from years of soccer, field hockey, and track. But I could tell by the way Alina was sitting with her tray in her lap, her chair pushed back from the table, that she would like nothing more than an excuse to leave. We were allowed to eat our lunches outside, but no one ever did during the winter. We got some funny looks pushing open the doors and slipping out into the yellowing grass. I'd been looking forward to telling Alina the story of the widower's clock for hours, but now that I was alone with her, I hesitated to jump straight into it. Are you okay? Alina shifted uncomfortably. Yeah, but I haven't done so great with crowds lately, especially when I'm eating. We were huddled in the corner of the doorway, trying to use the building to block the wind. I was nervous as I reached out to rub her arm, what I hoped was an understanding and reassuring gesture. She didn't flinch or pull away, she just stared at my hand for a long second before she whispered, "Thanks." I started telling her the story, exactly as Carrie told it to me, but had barely begun when the switch flipped in Alina's head, and she remembered where she heard it before. East Boston camps. Pretty much everyone in our town went to summer camp there when we were kids, but it was only 15 minutes outside of Nashua. One of the counselors there had been like Carrie and me. She used to delight in telling her ghost stories to younger campers. He loved it. He used to delight in telling ghost stories to younger campers. He loved it when the kids were too scared to sleep and kept their cabin chaperones up all night. For a second, I forgot why we were trying to track down this story and got lost in memories of camp. But Alina didn't. "Do you think this has anything to do with why he killed himself?" Her voice was steady,
but she fixed me with her eyes, and I could see how desperate she was for me to answer yes. Desperate to believe that it wasn't her fault. I think he suffered from depression. Elena's lip quivered, and her eyes filled with tears. I hugged her. Hey, listen to me. You didn't kill him. Elena gripped the collar of my flannel shirt and buried her head against my chest. I stood there, holding her, as she cried. The two of us were late to fifth period. At the end of the day, Fletcher was waiting for me in the parking lot. He'd already turned his car on and cranked the heater up to full blast. Even still, we were halfway home before it was warm enough for me to open up my jacket. He stared out the window. Dude, what's going on with you and Elena? I tried to look at him. His jaw was set. And for the first time in our lives, Fletch reminded me of his hard-ass father. I really didn't want to answer him. She asked me about a ghost story. Fletch's only answer was to let his eyes drift from the road. He studied my face for a long moment before he finally said, "Which one?" "The widower's clock. It's the one where..." "I know that one." It was barely a whisper. "Are you in a hurry to get home?" "No."
"Good."
Fletch pulled over by the side of the road, took a shuddering breath and punched the steering wheel twice and started bawling. He let it out. Everything he'd been holding in at school, everything that he'd been holding in around his dad, everything. Elena had been sad. Fletch was purging. During the days following Rob's suicide, seeing people break down like this was common, and it continued on longer in the morning counseling sessions, but at some point people put their guard back up. What had been appropriate emotions one day was suddenly back to being taboo the next, and for people like Fletch, they weren't ready to be in that emotional space again. Once he'd gotten most of it out, we started talking. Really talking. "I know it's unfair," he said. "I know it's not. Sure, he tried to be nice, but I'm sorry, I just fucking hate her." I didn't exactly blame Fletch for how he felt. Nate was a good guy. He knew that Elena wasn't obligated to reciprocate Rob's feelings simply because he was nice to her, but he watched his friend, dead or alive, burn for 4 hours, and part of him wondered if it would have still happened if only Elena had given Rob a chance. "You know, that's too much pressure to put on anyone," I said.
"I know."
I reminded Fletch of everything the counselors had told us. That feeling sad when you've been rejected is natural. It's normal behavior. It's a healthy behavior. You should feel sad whenever someone doesn't want to reciprocate their feelings. It is sad. But while there's always something that makes a person decide that they want to kill themselves now and not tomorrow or last week, It's not the final straw that breaks their back, it's all the weight that came before it. The underlying mental illness. Fletch looked down at his hands. "Yeah." There was no conviction in his voice. Fletch pulled his t-shirt up to his face and wiped the last of his tears away. He then started the car and we were moving, riding in silence. And after a few minutes, Fletch spoke again. "He thinks he found it." "What?" "Widower's clock." It was my turn to stare at Nate. "That's impossible." "You want to read it? The note he left for me?" In the period of time between the end of the Civil War and the start of the 1920s, the population of Boston, Massachusetts, had more than tripled. In fact, there were more people living in Boston in the 1920s than there are today. This put an amazing strain on the city's resources, particularly on their drinking water. To solve their water problem, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts undertook a number of public work projects, redirecting rivers and creating reservoirs. The largest of which is the Quabbin Reservoir on the Swift River Valley of Western Massachusetts. The Quabbin covers nearly 80 square miles and sports an impressive 180 miles of shoreline.
Creating the Quabbin meant flooding much of the Swift River Valley, and the Swift River Valley was home to four towns. Donna to the northeast, and Prescott to the northwest, with Greenwich wedged between them, and Enfield in the southwest. Enfield, where the Widower's Clock was supposedly built, now sits mostly submerged by 412 billion gallons of water. How in the hell would Robert Keenan have found anything there at all? What would there even be to find? 60-some-odd years in a flood after the fact, and it's not as though the Swift River Valley was flooded overnight. The people had years to move their homes and relocate out of the flood zone. Why would they leave behind a whole building? If it was there, wouldn't a clock tower peeking out of the water tend to draw the eye? I never felt comfortable in Fletcher's house. The first floor felt like a museum. Mr. Fletcher was strict, but it was Mrs. Fletcher who wanted her house to always resemble the cover of an interior decorating magazine. Now, call me crazy, but what's the point of having a house you're afraid to live in? Fletcher's room, on the other hand, had the opposite problem. First time I ever came over, at Mrs. Fletcher's insistence, I had to take my shoes off to go upstairs and then put them back on in Nate's room because, while he was sure there was broken glass somewhere, Fletcher wasn't quite sure where. As you could imagine, Nathan Fletcher and his mother fought quite a bit. Fletch gestured to his bed, and I parked myself on the corner of it with the few dirty clothes. What few prized possessions he owned, Fletch kept in the bottom right-hand drawer of the desk. But that's not where he pulled Rob's letter out of. No, the letter he kept tucked in a book on top of his nightstand. It occurred to me that he must have been reading it often. The invasion of privacy I felt when I read Alina's letter was nothing. Nothing compared to reading Fletch's as he sat next to me. The letter was exponentially more personal. Rob was exposed on the page. Reading it made me feel like I had walked in on him naked. Whereas the letter Rob gave Alina revealed a lot about himself, and next to nothing about her, this letter revealed a great deal about Rob as well as Fletch. Fletch and Rob had bonded when Rob was new and Fletch was going through his awkward phase. Apparently, I had been wrong about Fletch not getting down whenever he said the wrong thing. Warm and funny, confident around his friends, Fletch had spent most of his early teens afraid to speak in public. Maybe I hadn't noticed because he was older and I sort of looked up to him, or maybe I was just too absorbed in my own insecurities to see anyone else that they had their own. Either way, it was news to me. Rob's note to Alina had expressed a measure of guilt for leaving everyone behind to deal with the aftermath of his death. But in the letter he gave to Fletch, the guilt he articulated feeling was for having lived. He apologized profusely for having been a burden. He described himself alternatively as a baby and a leech, a drain on anyone foolish enough to move too close to him, and though he knew no one would see it like he did, Rob viewed his suicide as a charitable act. He was ridding his friends and family of himself. Despite my discomforts, reading such a personal letter, I devoured every word. I consumed the letter, hoping after each line that the next would finally illuminate for me what Robert Keenan had to do with the Widower's Clock, and finally, tucked amongst a list of reasons why he was going to go through with it, was what I'd been looking for. I will soon join them, staring at her face as she runs the endless race. I will soon join them, staring at her face as she runs the endless race. I looked up, disappointed and annoyed with how little Rob had written about the Widower's Clock, to find Fletch rocking back and forth in his chair. It made me feel like a piece of shit. You said he thought he found it.
Yeah.
How? Nathan Fletcher looked up at me with watery eyes and told me everything. Rob's medication had his depression mostly under control for the last 3 years. He still had bouts, but they were less frequent, less severe than he had been before, along with his much improved disposition. Rob had also been sleeping better, eating more, and his energy was way up, but he was never exactly happy. See, that's something most people don't understand about depression. It's not a mood, it's a disorder. Having the symptoms of this disorder in check doesn't make Rob happy, it made him not depressed. Rob still struggled to fit in and enjoy life. He was still unpopular. He was still misunderstood. One of the first things that Robert Keenan really enjoyed was running. He especially enjoyed cross-country. If I had to guess what appeal long-distance running held for Rob, I'd say that for someone who already felt their loneliness in a crowd, it must have been a relief to actually be alone. Just him, the woods, the next mile. And the Quabbin Reservoir offered a lot of next miles. Rob had been exploring its trail since he was a child, when they lived in Amherst. His family used to visit the Quabbin on the weekends. They'd hike or picnic, and occasionally Mr. Keenan would take his two sons fishing. As a teenager, Rob looked for any excuse that he could find to get down there and just go, one foot in front of the other, till sundown, when visitors had to leave. Well, that summer, the summer of 1999, Rob made a lot of excuses to visit Quabbin. He had, for the third time, mustered up the courage to tell Elena Amenev how he felt about her, and for the third time, he had been rebuked. This time, a little less gently than before. It left Rob with a growing impression that the love of his life found him creepy. Running was the only thing that got his mind off of it. The Fletchers had three boys. The oldest, Samuel, had gone down to UMass and, after graduation, found work in the university's IT department. Fletch visited his brother often, and whenever he did, Rob would hitch a ride down to the Quabbin. Fletch would usually drop him off in the morning, and Rob would get picked up by family he still had in Amherst, or he would call Fletch's brother from the visitor center at the south end of the Windsor Dam, and Fletch would come get him. Once Rob had lost track of time and found himself after sundown, miles from the visitor center, that's when he heard them for the first time. Bells tolling the hour. They were scarcely detectable, as if they'd traveled a great distance and they had an odd, muffled quality that made them sound soft and deep. Rob stopped running and listened. He forgot all about Elena, forgot about contacting Fletch, forgot that he was an hour's drive away from the nearest person that he knew. He stood in the woods and turned to the wind to listen to this beautiful sound. If it was anything like me when I first heard them, he was overcome by a physical sensation of feeling like slipping under a warm blanket on a cold night. Then they were gone. Rob found himself once again in the dark woods with no idea how he'd get home. There's a trailer park, somewhat unusual in Massachusetts, a couple of miles southeast of the visitor center. Rob was lucky enough to get picked up on the road by one of its residents. She's probably barely 40, but looked like she was pushing 60, smoked continuously, and was the one who told Rob about what she called the spire in the woods. To her, the spire in the woods wasn't a ghost story. It was simply a fact of life. Like blind curves and sinkholes, one that was best to be avoided. She didn't have a first-hand account of her own, but she'd heard plenty of stories. She knew that some of the boys from her trailer park enjoyed getting drunk, getting stoned, and pissing in the reservoir late at night. They'd get a little thrill out of the idea that somewhere in Boston, some Harvard grad was drinking their urine. Occasionally, one of the boys would come back to his trailer, unsettled at having heard the eerie beauty of the bells. Quabbin Reserve was peppered with islands. The woman said the source of the bells was on one of them, an island just to the north of where the old Ware-Enfield Road turns into Quabbin Hill. Somewhere hidden in that island's wild-grown trees, the peak of an old spire, the sort that you might see on the top of a church, juts out of the ground. Now and again, someone went looking for it and never came back. Rumor around the trailer park was that back in 1996, John Wilkins and his cousin Anna found it, but only John came back. He killed himself about a month later. Since then, the park mothers had kept an extra close watch on their boys. Rob didn't really believe in any of it. He wasn't like me. The spire in the woods wasn't a spiritual quest. He wasn't trying to cling to the last lingering shreds of faith. He just wanted to hear the sound again, hear the bells as they chimed the hour. have that feeling of warmth and security wash over him. In the weeks that followed, Rob thought of nothing except the sound of the bells. Fletch thought that Rob was embellishing the incident, letting his memory get the best of him, but Rob was adamant that they were the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard. He insisted that something in the aging bells or the wind, as it carried the trolling through the woods, or the acoustics of the rock and the dirt surrounding the spire, lent them an ethereal quality. He was determined to find the spire. Rob began researching the Quabbin, and it wasn't long before he realized the connection between the spire and the widower's clock. He dismissed the ghost story, but he was thrilled that a master artisan lived in Enfield and sunk his fortune into constructing a clock tower, complete with bells and chimes. Fletch was skeptical. If Rob had heard anything at all, it must have come from somewhere else. A neighboring town, a proper church. Tower bells weigh hundreds, if not thousands of pounds. What would be ringing them? The wind? It would take a hurricane. But Rob was unfazed. He was going to find the spire in the woods. He was going to hear the bells again, and Fletch didn't see the harm in letting him try. A week before school started, Fletch set off for Amherst with Rob in tow. The pair of them spent the evening with Sam and his friends before cutting out around 9:45, heading down Route 9 until they reached Old Ware Enfield Road. They parked the car near the trailer park and hoofed it the 2 miles up or so to Old Ware, to the shore of the reservoir nearest the island, one of which Rob was positive housed the spire in the woods. Each having worn swimsuits under their clothes, they simply stripped down, stashed their things, and slipped into the water. The nearest island lay about 200 yards from the shore, and Fletch, never a strong swimmer, quickly realized he didn't have it in him to make it there. After a brief argument while treading water, Fletch turned back and Rob went on alone. They'd agreed Fletch would meet Rob back by Route 9 at 4 a.m. Fletch sat on the trunk of his car for hours, swatting mosquitoes, listening to frogs and crickets. First he was worried about Rob. Then he was pissed that Rob had gone by himself. Then he was worried again. Fletch set the alarm on his watch around 1:30 or so, laid out on his back seat, drifted off to sleep, wishing that he was drinking at his brother's. Fletch awoke to the passenger side door being thrown open. Rob jumped in and slammed the door closed. "Drive! Drive!" Fletch scrambled into the front seat, assuming park officials or the police were on pursuit. He gunned the engine and pulled out of the trailer park. Fletch was already on Route 9 before he haphazarded a glance at his friend. Rob was panicked. What happened? Rob said nothing. He just labored to catch his breath as he looked back towards the reservoir. Rob's adrenaline slipped away as Fletch drove. By the time they reached Sam's apartment, Rob was practically catatonic. "It took me weeks to pry it out of him," Fletch said. "He saw something down there."
"He found the spire?" I asked.
Fletch nodded.
"Did he go in?"
Rob had reached the first island. He'd been searching fruitlessly for nearly 40 minutes when he heard them. The bells. Being so much closer now, they were even clearer. He fell to his knees, letting their sensation, their warmth, wash over him for just a moment. He knew bliss. The bells rolled back like the ocean at low tide. Rob found himself shivering on the ground. He could hear nothing but frogs and crickets. He rose on unsteady legs, sure of only one thing. In an hour, he'd be there. He'd be standing before the spire. He'd hear the bells, feel them up close. He ran to the shore and dove into the waters. Rob emerged from the reservoir onto the rocky bank of a second and far larger island. He stumbled barefoot through the woods, increasingly aware of how dark it was beneath the trees, and the bell's siren call faded in his mind. He began to doubt himself. The island was nearly 2 miles long and a half mile across. He could search it all night and never find a damn thing. The bells chimed once more. He turned to face them.
And there it was.
In the center of a grove of dead trees, the spire jutted out from the ground like a pike set to receive a charge. Its white paint was oddly untouched by age. Small windows adorned each of its sides, framed by the dead trees and bathed in moonlight, called Unable to resist their song, yet too overwhelmed by their warmth to walk, Rob crawled to the spire like an infant to its mother. He pushed against the slats of the window. They gave way, and he squirmed his way inside. Rob landed onto the top of the staircase. As the bells continued to chime, he pulled his shuddering body down the stairs, deeper and deeper into the enveloping darkness within, until he found himself once more in the ethereal sounds and their radiating warmth. Once the silence returned, Rob strained in vain to see. The air was humid and black as ink. He could feel wood, dank and rotting, pressing against his bare calves. It gave him the impression he was sitting Indian style inside of a living thing, like Jonah in the whale. Slowly, Rob rose to his feet. He held his hands out in front of him, and he groped blindly. He hoped that he'd find a wall or a banister to the stairs, anything that would give him a clue about his surroundings. Instead, he found nothing. Forcing himself to shuffle deeper into the impermeable darkness, his outstretched fingers recoiled from the soft surface they encountered. What was it? He shook as he reached out, letting his hands land once more on the chest-high object in front of him. It only extended out to about the width of his shoulders. The cloth hung loose over something hard that his hands couldn't identify. Rods? Dowels? His probing fingers traced up the object's outer edge until he felt something he could identify. He froze. His fingers were in the eye socket of a skull. His thumb rested on its teeth. The bells rang again. If only inside Rob, as his mind's eye showed him the endless dance. He sat there in the dark, his unseeing eyes transfixed by the clockmaker's wife as she was dragged on her post through the twirling gauntlet of union automations. He saw her, alive and dead, the blush of youth, the maggot of decay, twitch and scream and moan as her body was pierced by countless bayonets. He saw her face as she ran the endless race. Rob shrank and shriveled, collapsing to the floor. Like a wounded animal, he crawled and he clawed his way back until he hit the wall, and even then he didn't stop. He pushed against it with all of his strength, hoping to retreat further. His flailing limbs struck a step, the first of many. With what little control he had over his frenzied mind, bolted for the surface and an escape from the moist pit and the clockmaker's wife. Rob scrambled up the twisting stairs on all fours like a dog. He tore his way through the window and collapsed on the ground. Fresh air felt alien in his lungs, as if it were his first breath. He took two more as he lay on the ground, but realized that although he hadn't a clue what time it was, he couldn't be there when the bells chimed. He ran and swam and ran and swam, and he didn't look back until he was in the car. Wetch put his face in his hands. I shouldn't have let him go alone. So you believe him? I tried to say, in as comforting a tone as I could, but I think it came out a little accusatory. Wetch hesitated. Yeah, I do. I had so many questions I wanted to ask him, but I didn't think Fletch could take it. He choked up several times while relaying Rob's story, and the way that his shoulders were slumping reminded me of the way Rob's parents had looked at his son's funeral. I should have gone with him, he said, looking up at me. I let it lie. As I left Fletch's house, every hair on my body was standing on end, but at that point, as much as I wanted to, I still wasn't ready to accept the story of a spire in the woods. Not at face value. When we studied the fall of the House of Usher in English earlier that year, Mrs. Thorne had made it a point to draw our attention to two of Poe's opium references, and how Roderick Escher displayed symptoms of withdrawal. She explained that Poe's stories frequently incorporated both blatant and subtle references to intoxications and hallucinogenics, in order to enhance the sense of phantasmagoria and help more skeptical readers suspend their disbelief. I knew very little about depression, and even less about antidepressants, but at the time, I didn't think it was beyond the realm of possibility that Robert Keenan's encounter with the clockmaker's wife had more to do with the sudden onset of major depression episodes than with a dead woman. I spent the night reading about depression, tricyclic, MAO inhibitors, and SSRIs. There were no answers, just endless possibilities. It wasn't unheard of for major depressive episodes to be accompanied by delusions or even outright hallucinations. Psychotic disorders were sometimes less obvious in patients whose presenting problem with depression. Hallucinations were rare side effects of SSRIs, and MAO inhibitors could cause serotonin syndrome, which can cause hallucinations. That was before getting into the countless drug interactions, which, without knowing exactly what Rob was taking, couldn't begin to map out. I knew Scary Carrie would love to hear every detail Fletch had told me about the spire in the woods, but on Tuesday morning, I just didn't feel like tracking her down. I wanted to talk to Alina. The ride into school hadn't been as awkward as I had anticipated. Fletch was quieter than usual, and I was content to stare out my window and daydream about what I was going to tell Alina. I wondered what she thought about Fletch's story, and whether or not I should gloss over my own doubts. I also wondered if she'd cry. I feel embarrassed, even all these years later admitting it, but a part of me was hoping that she would. Then I'd have an excuse to hug her again. They could be dependable. Comforting. Boyfriend material. It was the kind of fantasy that marked me as a beta male. The sort of guy who, even in his own daydreams, couldn't think of a single reason that he deserved the girl. I roved the junior high hallways and the cafeteria, but I couldn't find Alina anywhere. I heard from DeLuca that she called out sick. I spent the rest of the day in a funk. Carrie and I had gym 7th period, the last class of the day. It was too cold to go out to the field, so we had to choose between 3 or 4 indoor activities. Ordinarily, I would have opted for floor hockey, the only gym class activity I ever really enjoyed, but I felt obligated to update Carrie on what I'd learned about Rob and the Spire, so I joined her in the auxiliary gym for a little ping pong, a game I had no idea she was good at. Or it could have happened exactly like that, Carrie said, acing me for the 3rd straight time. I was surprised that Scary Carrie wasn't as skeptical as I was. I mean, sure, Carrie absolutely believed in ghosts, and of course, I desperately wanted to, but we weren't completely credulous about every story that we heard. We didn't relish wandering around graveyards and old buildings for no good reason. We weren't looking to kill time. We did it because we wanted to find something. We wanted to pull back the curtain and glimpse the grandeur of creation. We wanted to feel small in the presence of the infinite and know, if only for a moment, it was more than food, sex, and the petty minutiae of social interaction. What it came down to was that while I believed Fletch and I believed that Fletch believed Rob, I didn't know that I believed Rob. There was a difference between lying and being wrong. Carrie and I had developed criteria for identifying the more promising leads, and the Spire in the Woods had a lot going against it. Secondhand accounts, stories with an undercut of the social control, witnesses with a history of mental illness, these were red flags. And Rob's story had all of them. Do you want to check it out? It's kind of cold for a swim. I just want to see if we can hear the bells. Yeah, maybe. I don't know, it's kind of far. Of course, there's another reason I was reluctant to head all the way to Quabbin Reservoir with Scary Carrie. She looked at me like I had just insulted her. She knew precisely what the other reason was. Our last ghost hunting expedition had been a disaster. A very personal disaster. Carrie was old for our year. She turned 16 at the tail end of our freshman year and had gotten her license the very first day of summer break. It was perfect, save for one thing. No car. Carrie's parents were divorced. Her dad had moved to New Jersey for a job. He paid his alimony and child support every month, but he just wasn't a very wealthy man. Carrie's mom had never gone to college. She had to work full-time at the deli counter at a local market basket just to make ends meet, which meant most days she had the car. But at night, when the store was closed, Carrie had access to the world's oldest, crappiest station wagon. For the most part, Carrie's newfound freedom changed her life very little. Mainly, her trips involved picking up the members of her small group of friends and delivering them to Dan Bergen's to watch anime and other horror movies in his basement. We only hung out twice that summer. Both times, Scary Carrie picked me up in what I called Ecto-1, and we went ghost hunting. Our first trip was to the Blood Cemetery. That's how we discovered the story of Abel Blood was, well, a steaming load. We dressed in all black, par the course in Carrie's case, and brought flashlights, wax paper, and crayons. We also took the silver crucifixes my parents had given me as a First Communion present, and my mother's Bible, just in case we saw something. It was fun scrambling over the old stone wall, sneaking through the cemetery with our flashlights held low, trying not to step on anybody's grave. Even after seeing that the years of death didn't line up, we still checked out the curve where the ghost of the little girl supposedly ran out in front of the passing cars. The blind curve was indeed full of skid marks. It also had about 20 feet in front of it a deer crossing sign. But even after seeing that, the years of death did, two or three weeks later, we went to a charity auction at the rec center and slipped up the stairs to the attic. The stairs squeaked beneath our feet, and even though, at worst, we'd just be thrown out of the rec center, we were terrified of getting caught. The attic hadn't changed in the 7 or so years since my last visit. A couple of card tables housed bins full of crafting materials, a pair of filing cabinets set against the back wall gathering dust. And most importantly of all, despite it being June, there were still cold spots. You stand outside of one, reach an arm in, and try to define the boundary of the warm and cold air. It was tricky. The shift in temperature wasn't as great as I remember from when I was a kid, and there were no hard, fine edges between the hot and the cold air. The temperature just seemed to bleed from one area to another, like brine in an estuary. I experimented sticking my crucifix into the heart of the cold spot and felt nothing. If anything, it felt like the cold spots were fading away. Carrie suggested we try talking to the spirit of Jennifer Wilkins while we still could. I shrugged. After you? We'd forsaken most of our ghost hunting kit, as it would have been awfully conspicuous carrying around a Bible and a couple of flashlights. I still had my crucifix, but I doubted it'd be necessary. The stories of the Silver Spectre were all quite tame. We had, however, brought a couple of sticks of incense, which we lit with a very old Zippo that had once belonged to my grandfather. Carrie had bought the incense from a New Age store, sort of place that you shop at if you were inclined to believe in neo-paganism or healing crystals. The saleswoman told her it was supposed to make it easier for spirits to pass into our realm. But to me, it just smelled like sandalwood. Carrie spoke in a lilting tone. Jennifer, are you here with us? I burst out laughing and Carrie went beet red. She punched me in the arm and whispered for me to be quiet, pointing to the floor where beneath our feet the auction was taking place. Carrie tried again. Jennifer, if you can hear me, give us a sign. We stood still in absolute silence, waiting for an answer. It came in the form of an industrial air conditioner, mounted to the ceiling of the floor below us, cycling on. A few gasps in the floorboards lining up perfectly with the AC's large vents. We couldn't stop laughing at the spirit of Jennifer returning the cold spots to full force. Once we'd regained our composure, Carrie and I decided to head over to Bickford's for a bite to eat while we conducted the post-mortem on our latest failure. Now, a deer crossing sign and an air conditioner doesn't necessarily disprove that Blood Cemetery and our town rec center are haunted, but they certainly made us feel rather foolish. So while I'd gorged myself on Eggs Benedict, which I had only recently discovered, and Carrie nursed a cup of coffee, we started tossing around ideas for other expeditions. No local place, she said. Gotta stay objective. Can't be some place that we've grown up thinking is haunted. You just don't want anyone we know hearing our little sing-talking to the spirit world voice. Carrie, in mock anger, reached over, grabbed a home fry off my plate, and threw it at me. It had taken her a long time to get comfortable with me teasing her. I guess after a lifetime of being mocked about her weight and her appearance, the idea that it was only the way I expressed affection took some getting used to. There was a few places in and around Boston that we wanted to check out, but most of them were landmarks or buildings that were still in use. Neither of us was eager to get arrested, particularly not Carrie, who was going to have a hard enough time getting into college, so Boston was out. And most of Lowell, too. We dismissed a couple of nearby legends, the Gelson Road Cemetery, which had no actual history surrounding it, just a hodgepodge of random urban legends, and the Blue Lady out in Wilton, New Hampshire, who sounded somewhat promising, but was most frequently sighted during the harvest moon, which we wouldn't get until late September. Eventually, we settled on Eunice Williams' covered bridge in Greenfield, Massachusetts. It had everything going for it, a traumatic event, consistent sightings, and no air conditioning. The only downside was that for us, Greenfield was a solid 2-hour drive each way, and that was if the MapQuest directions were up to date. My big if. I didn't see Carrie again that summer. Life just got in the way. For Carrie, it was too difficult to work around her mom's schedule, especially after a tiny little accident she had backing out of a space at a mall, resulting in her losing her privileges for a month. Well, for me, it was the pool Christy McDowell's parents had put in that June. All my feelings for Christy and our other mutual female friends was mostly platonic. I was 15, and they were in bikinis. By comparison, ghost hunting just didn't seem quite as exciting. Knowing how my friends felt about her, I never invited Kelly to tag along. Of course, in fairness to me, pool parties weren't exactly her cup of tea. When school started up again in the fall, Carrie and I resumed talking about our trip to Greenfield, but it wasn't until Rob Keenan killed himself and I made an effort to spend more time with her that we got around to actually going. Carrie picked me up one Friday evening in mid-November. Mrs. Peterson had opened the store that morning and would be closing the next day, meaning that we had Ecto-1 all night. We just needed to get her car back before she woke up, and she'd be none the wiser. Driving around with friends was still novel at that point in my life. 3 hours passed by in a blur of jokes and gossip and screaming along to what little music Carrie and I could agree on. She used to have this mixtape dominated by Nine Inch Nails and Rage Against the Machine that was a staple of our time in Ecto-1. I think we listened to it straight through 2.5 times that night. We only got turned around once and arrived at Eunice Williams' covered bridge absolutely pumped. We pulled into the bridge, cut the motor, honked once, and waited for Eunice. Now, Eunice Williams was not a resident of Greenfield. She had actually lived in a nearby Deerfield back in the late 1600s. At the time, Deerfield was the northwesternmost post of New England. Deep in the heart of the former... At the time, Deerfield was the northwesternmost outpost of New England, deep in the heart of the former Pocumtuck Nation. Before the settlers had arrived in Deerfield, the Pocumtuck had already been weakened by European diseases and war with the Mohawk people. When the settlers and Pocumtuck clashed over resources, the settlers easily drove the remaining Pocumtuck from the land. Well, the Pocumtuck, however, were not ready to admit defeat. They allied themselves with French settlers and other French-allied First Peoples in Canada, and in 1704 led an offensive raid against Deerfield's English settlers. The French and Native Americans killed 56 settlers and burned much of the town to the ground, captured over 100 survivors, and forced them to march through the brutal winters into Quebec. The march would take months. Among the captured survivors was Eunice Mather Williams, her husband, Minister John Williams, and 5 of their 7 children. Her infant daughter and 6.5-year-old son were both killed during the raid, but John and Eunice were determined to be strong for their other children and fellow captives. The Williamses quoted scripture, led the group in prayer, and took turns carrying their younger children until they reached the Green River. Eunice fell during the crossing. Despite having survived her plunge, the Pocumtuck warriors decided that Eunice's exposure to the icy water had weakened her too much to continue the march. So, he hacked her to pieces in front of her husband and the remaining children. Legend has it that Eunice appeared on the bridge over the waters where she was killed, asking any mortals that she finds there of news of her children and husband. Locals say that she can be summoned simply by cutting your engine and honking your horn. Now, we'd been sitting there in Ecto-1 with the engine off and no heat when a thought occurred to me. Why would the ghost of a woman who died a couple of centuries before the invention of the automobile, respond to a horn being honked. I could see the gears turning in Scary Carrie's head as she processed the anachronism. Well, maybe she's just... Fuck. I laughed as Carrie turned on the car to get the heat going again.
And you couldn't have thought of this before we drove out here, she asked.
Well, maybe the bridge isn't haunted, just that Eunice probably isn't a car gal. We waited for a bit, then got out of the car and poked around the bridge on foot. I've always liked covered bridges, ever since seeing Disney's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow cartoon as a kid. And there's a nifty little plaque at this one that tells the whole story of Eunice Williams. We scrambled down to the banks of the river. It's not exactly the Mississippi, but it was easy to see how difficult it would have been to ford, especially under the strained circumstances Eunice was facing. I skipped a few pebbles, a difficult feat in fast-moving water before you get cold, and we decided to get back to the car. Maybe it was the increasingly likely prospect that another of our missions had gone to prove to be a waste, or maybe it was just the hour and the warm air of the heater blasting on our faces and making us sleepy. But whatever the cause, our energy was fading fast, and our conversation had turned serious. Well, serious by high school standards.
Do you think that Kim Murray's pretty?
I did not think she was pretty, but that put me in a precarious position. Physically, Kim had her faults, but objectively speaking, she was significantly more attractive than Carrie, a girl Drew DeLuca once described with what was, for Drew, a considerable amount of sympathy as unfortunate-looking. Carrie shifted in her seat to face me. I don't know. Never gave much thought to it. Why?
We were at Dan's the other night, and she was talking about how much she likes knowing that guys masturbate while thinking about her.
I don't think this is a topic of conversation I want to pursue. Carrie grunted softly.
That's what I said. It's kind of gross.
There was a pause. When Carrie spoke again, her voice caught in her throat.
And then Kim said, well, then, I guess you're lucky. You don't have to worry about anyone doing that over you.
My cheeks burned with embarrassment. I didn't know what to say. I never imagined Kim would share her sexual insecurities with me. In part because I never thought of her in sexual terms. On some levels, I didn't think I'd ever fully processed for me that Carrie was a girl, like Elena or Christy. That's not to say that I was confused about her gender identity, but that... Because I found her unattractive, my mind had neutered her and had significantly reduced her as a human.
Carrie started to cry. And I leaned over to give her a hug.
She let out a few hushed sobs onto my shoulder as I patted her broad back, and at some point she stopped crying. It took me a second to notice. But what I thought was her taking a shuddering breath, or maybe just a tear-covered cheek sliding across my skin, was actually Carrie kissing my neck. I wanted to leap in the back seat to lurch away from Carrie and retreat to the furthest recess of Ecto-1. I wanted to throw open my door, I wanted to sprint to the nearest house, and demand its occupants permit to shower. But I couldn't do that. As revolted as I was that my actions and intention had been so wildly misconstrued, Carrie was still my friend, and she was vulnerable, and she didn't deserve that. I froze, hoping that she'd realize I wasn't reciprocating. The nuzzling and kissing continued. I guess she didn't, or maybe she didn't realize that this was a red flag. We never spoke about what happened in Greenfield, but either way, she needed a clearer stop sign. I put my hand on her shoulder and gently pushed myself away from her. She got the message. I don't think of you like that.
I had trouble spitting it out. She nodded. We're friends, I said.
Uh-huh. The trip home was one of the longest car rides of my life. Carrie never turned on the radio. The only words out of my mouth were the turns I called out for our MapQuest directions. I felt shallow. I think we both knew that I'd only said we're friends to soften the blow. I wouldn't have dismissed the affection of any other female friends so readily. Even Christy McDowell, whom I'd been friends with since the third grade. I would never have pushed her away like that. The following Monday, I made it a point to talk to Carrie in class like nothing happened. She played along for a bit, but then asked me for a little space. Frankly, I was relieved to give it to her. I only told a couple of people about Scary Carrie kissing my neck. DeLuca thought that it was hilarious. He wasn't the most sensitive guy in the world. Carrie was a bit more sympathetic. She reminded me that I was entitled to have my tastes. I appreciated hearing that. But I still felt like shit. I'd set out to make Carrie feel better about herself and had done nothing of the kind. I never thought of myself as the sort of guy who'd judge a girl based on her looks, but apparently I was. Alina didn't return to school for a whole week after our last conversation. She told everyone who asked that she'd had the flu, but later confessed to me that she couldn't take being surrounded by people. It was too noisy, too overwhelming, too many eyes staring at her. She needed to be alone. I didn't see her at lunch that day. Or never again. The anxiety she felt being surrounded by people was at its worst when she was trying to eat. So her parents arranged for her to eat in her guidance counselor's office. When I found out, I knew that it was good for Alina. But I couldn't help but feel like my days would be a little drearier without being able to see her across the cafeteria. Her wild hair. That smirk, if it ever returned. And that was to say nothing of the wonder that years of track and cross-country had done for her legs. I finally caught up with her on Friday morning. She was at her locker. To cut down on the amount of time she'd have to spend jammed between chatty classmates, Alina had taken to cramming every book and binder she needed until lunch into her backpack. She looked like a freshman. Hey, Alina. She didn't look up.
Oh, hey.
I dropped down next to where she was crouching and lowered my voice.
I spoke with Fletch.
Alina froze. I couldn't tell if she was nervous or excited. She took a couple of deep breaths and she turned towards me.
Did you see it?
Yeah. Basically, said the same thing as yours. She deflated but continued.
But then he told me what happened.
Are you going to be at lunch? She bit her lower lip, and she considered for a second.
No.
Oh, well, we could...
What do you have last period?
Gym.
You skip it?
I'd never cut a class in my life. Absolutely.